Welcome back. Level 20, episode 9, Turbo. Go watch the movie if you haven't already. If you need a place to find the movie, you can always check out podcast.level1.ski. Got a super awesome episode, a couple special guests coming up for you. Real quick, check out the calendar on the Level 1 website if you want to find a tour stop for romance near you. We have Denver September 21st, Reno and Salt Lake City September 28th, High Five Festival in Annecy October 5th, IF3 and Bozeman on the weekend of October 28th, and Bend on November 2nd. Add in more all the time. If you don't see your town or your region on there, then fill out the form and try and host your own showing. Bring the movie to your town and throw a sick party. Get all your homies together. And if you don't think you're going to be able to make it to a showing, go pre-order the DVD so you can get it coming to your mailbox as soon as possible. We have that live on the website right now, too. Other ways to support, rate us on iTunes, go cop something from the store. We have the new Wells Lamont X Level 1 mitts for this year up on the website, so check those out. Super sick. Last thing, email us questions if you got them. We might do another episode with Decker and Tom. So if you have anything for them, too, drop us a line, email it in, podcast@level1productions.com. I think that's it. Enjoy the episode. Hope you find it as entertaining as we did. We are here in Level 1 HQ in Denver with Josh Berman, Friedel Cody, myself, Connor Smith, and joined by the magic of the internet by Kyle Decker and Tom Wallish. What's up, dudes?
Yo, boys. What's how's up? It going?
It is going excellent. Tom, I don't think you need any introduction, but if you're not a Level 1 diehard, Kyle Decker, who are you? How'd you come into the fold?
Oh, Decker doesn't need any introduction, but let's do it anyway. It's a formality.
I came into the fold back in, I was an intern for Long Story Short and then a full-time editor for Real Time, but Turbo was really my first year as a full-time film and edit. Full-timer for Level 1, and I worked with Level 1 through Sunny.
Who were you working with this year shooting for Turbo? What was your crew?
I mean, my core crew was... the first few years was like the Wallish, Hornbeck, Amet was like the tightest crew. And then, you know, I spent a lot of time with Liam and Vanular as well. And then everyone else at the park shoots.
Fuck yeah.
You kind of, so you had spent 2007 filming for Rage Films with like pretty much strictly you and Amet.
And Hornbeck.
Okay. So... I know that you cut Amet's part in Enjoy. Is that the movie?
Mm-hmm.
And then...
That one's heat.
Obviously helped edit Real Time, but then coming in 2008, I guess Berman must have offered him a job.
Yeah, well, I remember, I think we briefly talked about it the year before, and I think Rage put another year of filming on the table for you. Is that correct?
Yeah, I wanted to work...
The year before Turbo.
I wanted to work for Level 1 right after Long Story Short, but I wasn't... quite ready, and I don't think Level 1 quite had the budget to hire a third guy. So had an opportunity with Rage, learned a ton with Dan Narkunis, who now shoots surfing, and then kind of got my feet wet with really going out in the backcountry in snowmobiles and doing it proper for a year. Because before that, it was 3 years experience of filming a local movie with my friends in Ohio. So certainly had a lot to learn, and then jumped in with Level 1 for Turbo full on.
Oh man, that weekend in Ohio, first time we met Decker, remember getting off the plane and meeting you and Chip Callback. Both of you guys are wearing your OFS Media uniforms. And what was that, Shanghai 6?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We did a Level 1 premiere with the local shop, and they were like Little Mountain Limited. And the owner, Greg McGuire, was like, hey, I want to do your guys' premiere up proper. I want to bring in like another big film production. Like, who do you want to bring in? I was like, see about Level 1. I think Berman's sister at the time was doing the tour and reached out, and he ended up coming out, and that kind of sparked a friendship. In the following year, he came out, and I kind of guided him, Tim Russell, and Craig Coker and Liam around, around Ohio.
Yeah.
For Long story short. And then we kind of just stayed in touch, and one thing led to another, ended up interning, and then full time.
Oh, I do remember when we did bring you on full time, that was a major step for level one. Because to that point, it had really just been Friedel and I. And I think bringing you on allowed us to grow the program and do so many things that we wouldn't have been able to do without you. And it really crossed my mind watching Turbo last night in particular, because that for me was one of the first years that I was able to put a lot of my time and resources into filming backcountry, almost exclusively, like certainly more so than I had done in the past. And it really was because you stepped up into that role for, I'd say, half the season to take on a lot of the street stuff and let me redirect attention to backcountry and POW. And I mean, that also allowed us to bring a couple more guys into the crew and make more commitments to athletes. And major growth opportunity for us. And seeing the movie last night just made me realize how big an impact you played.
Thanks.
Yeah, I remember you just hit the ground running because you had, what was your first
hungry
trip? I mean, the trailer? The oh my God, yeah.
You had that shoot now.
Level one was like, obviously, what everyone that's listening to this was like, you're listening to this because you're a fan of level one. And, you know, just being a kid from Ohio, and then all of a sudden you're like, holy shit, like I'm on a trip with level one, and like it was just such a big deal. And like back then, the mentality with everyone was like, it was just such a like, I'm gonna just go all in, and like I'm trying to prove, like, you know, really go all in. So we did that. I think I didn't really have like a first official trip, but I was living in Salt Lake at the time, and so was Wallish, and we started shooting together, and like that really sparked. We really didn't shoot, but we shot one park shoot for Rage Films the year before, but I mean, that was really our first introduction to like all in, and it kind of led to a full season. We got a couple shots in Salt Lake, and the momentum just started going nuts. And I remember like telling Berman or sending Berman clips and being like, dude, wait do you see this. And then I think the first big trip is we did either Minnesota with Wallace Hornbeck and Matt, and Austin Holt came as a photographer, and that was like
in the Chevy Tahoe.
First time we went to Minnesota, it was just like we were just seeing all these old spots from, you know, snowboard movies, and we were just frothing at being able to like, it was a good year, and just like hit the ground running.
Yeah, the Salt Lake stuff was ridiculous. I remember it was early too. It might have been like rewatching my segment. There's like a cable cam shot that you rigged up. It took like 3 hours in Salt Lake, just me and Kyle, and like you would never use a cable cam anymore. Yeah, and
those
it was like
took so much
hours
time
of work for him, but he was so hungry to get a shot. And I was like, yeah, I'll stay out till 3 a.m. Let's go. And nowadays it's like, I would have gone to bed, dude. I don't got 3 hours to watch you set up this cable cam.
Now you can just pick up a drone and like fly it and get a way better shot. But back then I was like at Home Depot, like trial and error building this thing. Cause I think MacDog had one and I wanted to try to figure it out, but like, it was such a failure 90% of the, like half the time. But I was like, is like the only affordable way for us to get a shot like that is just a gravity fed like cable cam. And
you got some clips in the movie though.
Yeah, you
so
did.
So MacDog also had introduced the dolly in a big way in 2007 with Picture This.
That was the big deal.
And it kind of blew open the doors on like filmmakers are now going to progress as much as the writers type situation. So I think you guys, what? Who made the first dolly level one, Berman or Decker?
No,
was it an arms race? Was there it was PVC piping?
Yeah. It's funny.
I feel like I made one with Neil, actually.
I feel like it's the same revolution as I think we're finally tamed down again, but the same drone revolution of like everyone gets this new toy and
new
then
toy.
All of a sudden the movies it's like the overuse of the dolly that like a couple years after that MacDog film and ski movies, it was like, and I was one of them, like everyone just like got a new toy and was trying to show who. It was like almost a competition on the filmer end too. Like you're friends with other filmers, like a AJ DeCoulis with 4x9 or like the guys from Poor Boys, and everyone was kind of like secretly the filmers are like battle, trying to almost like film a better part than the skiers are trying to. It was like a cool, like everyone was feeding off each other, and it really like grew the cinematography until like a Kurt Morgan came along and just ruined that whole that whole party.
All right, everybody, go get a Cineflex.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think we did a pretty good job, man. Like Friedel said, you definitely got a couple cable cam shots in the movie, and I remember watching you set this thing up and use it in a couple occasions. And for one, I think you're flying blind, right? Like we're not doing any kind of remote.
I tried a screen. Video transmitter, but it like
never worked.
Yeah, it was pretty blind.
Yeah. So between that and then just like, you know, timing and ability to control the thing, because of course it's gravity fed. It wasn't on any kind of like servo motor, so we're just kind of like letting it go. Like, oh, I hope it goes.
Or having like a line to follow with it that you're sort of like letting out.
Yeah. Or making sure that it doesn't like slam into a tree or something at the end. Yep. But yeah, it was actually kind of remarkable looking at a few of those shots and some of the ones that stood out. Liam Downey's POW shots, a couple little.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Little
Hornbeck
POW lines.
Wall ride.
Yeah.
I think the Downey
one
actually probably turned out the best, that or the Hornbeck wall ride. But dude, it's the amount of patience it takes from, you know, I'm looking at this as like, a filmer will spend all day to set up a shot, but you also have to have like patient skiers, because like Liam had to sit up there for like probably 2 hours for him to get one basic POW slash, or like Hornbeck, these guys all had like were patient, and I think that's why it worked. They were easy to work with. I think Level One had a good core group of riders that like appreciated a good shot, and the filmer tried to find the best balance of when you could burn their time up and when you didn't.
Yeah, well, they had trust in you too. I mean, you weren't just a wild card filmer.
For sure. It was the friendships and the personal relationships that made all that stuff even work, because yeah, you're not some like random filmer dude, because then they would have killed you and then left your body in the woods on Guardsman's Pass. but everybody was on the same team working together pretty clearly, and a lot of trust and mutual respect. I think that's what it took.
Walsh, I think Connor has a mess of stuff for you, but I don't know if I've ever asked you this, but because I think you just kind of all of a sudden were in the crew and doing stuff with Level One even the year prior, but did you like starting off this season filming, were you like, obviously you had to keep your allegiances to AJ and Napes and 4x9, but was it like, were you just going to do both, or was it weird to leave your homeboys, your college? Cause you guys had 4x9 was like, A squad, that was a tight crew.
Luckily, it was, like, tight enough, and there was a big enough crew. Like, it's not like that anymore because we're all older now, but at that point, there was, like, 10 people wanting to shoot in Salt Lake with our 4x9 crew, and, like, me leaving was almost, like, a godsend for the other homies. Like, oh, okay, nice. Like, I'll have a chance to, like, hit the rail. Wallace won't be, like, hiking, like, 100 times faster than me and trying to get a shot. So, like, me and Kyle actually, like, it worked good.
Erased
I mean,
the top.
Yeah, like, I don't know. I was always the guy, like, hustling probably a little too hard to get, like, another hit, stay later, try something crazier, and, like, I think it was fun.
Yeah, you were
for
sucking
me
up all the oxygen.
Kinda, maybe. I was hustling a little bit, but no,
it was paying off though for you.
It was fun. Man. I mean, ever since like the real time park shoots, and then like when Kyle was in Salt Lake, it was so easy. And like AJ and Napes were shooting Rich or Tim, and like our other buddies doing one spot, and they're like, "Oh, we're going here," and we were like kind of working with them. Like me and Kyle would go do one thing, and then I'd meet up with them the next day while Kyle was doing something else to shoot something. Like, I kind of collabed that year and did a 4x9 seg and a Level One seg, but it was definitely like...
And a field seg.
And a field seg, man.
And probably six other.
But that one, Kyle was, like, so close and, like, got along with all the crew so easy that, like, I obviously, too, was like, oh, man, this guy's got a cable cam. I got to link up with him.
So tell me really quick, when and where did you guys first meet?
And was there beef potentially?
Oh yeah, there was. At first.
Okay, because I swear I remembered something going on.
I will keep it vague, but basically, like, it just comes down to like raw passion. Like AJ and his crew are so passionate, and me and my crew, it's like Hornbeck and Amet, and it's like we're all two peas out of the pod, and now we're all like best friends. But basically, like, you know, just simple talking shit back and forth.
The big beef was over spots in Salt Lake. Yeah. Like, who had done what on what spot? Who was burning who on what spot? And whether it was like you were burning me to burn me specifically, if you're going around trying to burn me, or are you just doing you? And there was... So it almost got violent there for a little.
Yeah, it was a short-term thing, and then
we all
kind of realized that, like... And I feel like a lot of people, when you run into somebody that's... Like, I mean, whether it's Tom as a skier or AJ as a filmer, like, we're so much alike, yet, like, and you know, like, it's kind of this weird, like, Midwest or East Coast rivalry where, like, you get better. This is such a Hornbeck line I'm kind of stealing from him, but his mentality is, like, he was always trying to burn his friends and, like, get better. Like, I'm going to burn this dude on, like, this and that. And that's what ends up feeding you, but it was, like... There was definitely rocky at first with me and Wallace or me, the 4x9 crew, vice versa.
It was definitely you and AJ or you and the crew, and me and Hornbeck were like beefing, like hated each other.
Yeah.
And
now we're like best friends.
Something really early on where we're talking about like who people are going to be working with, and like there's some context about like, yeah, Decker, you get like link up with Wallace, and there was like, oh man, like, that guy. And then I remember either a conversation or a phone call where Decker's like, yeah, you know, he's a pretty good guy. He's kind of cool. It's going to work out all right.
It turns out we ended up becoming just absolute best friends. But there was definitely some beef at first.
I don't even think we actually like met each other. It was just like.
No, probably not. Probably not.
It was
not.
Just like, yo, this guy thinks he's like. He's you know, tough, I remember everyone just talking shit about him. And it's like, oh, this guy, like, yeah, Tom Wallace, whatever, like, super unknown.
Well, it's the proxy war, too, because you were probably beefing with Wallace through Hornbeck, who was probably your tightest homie at that time.
Yeah.
And Wallace is like, Wallace and Hornbeck are just ultra at each other's throats. Like, who's getting the first pretzel on this one?
Exactly. That's exactly.
You're just going to get behind whatever your crew. I mean, it's a class. And I wish there was more of that. The more I talk about it, I wish there was like more, the like little like crew beefs. Well, I'm sure I'm not going to mention
so
like
much.
Level one had some. Every crew stepped, I'm sure,
there
had
is.
Some. And it like,
always.
It's like so ridiculous, but it's also like
kind
pretty
awesome.
Healthy for like how. Like work twice as hard because you're like, oh yeah, like, you know, this dude's
sharpens
doing it.
The
and I'm
swords.
Like, yeah, sharpens the swords. You can't
that's
like
a nice one.
Now everyone's just like all friends.
Well, we're also like past like miss me with all that bullshit. We're in a miss me with that bullshit stage, but I'm sure there's plenty of other 18 and 20 year olds out there beefing hard right now.
I was gonna say, man, I look around, like, raise your hand if you got gray hair.
Yeah.
Or no hair.
Yeah, raise your hand if you don't have hair.
Yeah, and I think you learn as you get older that, like, especially now, there's, like, now if I see any crew, even if they, like, have, and I don't have a specific, but if there was a crew right now that had, like, beef with me or Wallace, I'd be like, it's almost like, hell yeah. Like, I almost see a little bit of myself in them, and I'm like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Like, that is so healthy for, like.
Like, oh, man, like, I'm kind of flattered that these kids wanted to take me
well,
on.
Well, all it means is there's like extremely passionate
man.
Kids still in skiing, and that is pretty rad. They're so caught up in like what them and their crew are doing, and they're just like, and it's why we all got into it. Like we're all like wildly passionate about something, and when you get passionate about something, you're gonna get fired up too.
Yeah, straight up.
Word. Wally, you mentioned those real-time park sessions. Was that going on even there? Because you wouldn't know it from the movie, but that's the first place that you, Amet, Hornbeck are all in one place in a level one film.
No, definitely not there. I guess more than anything, that was probably, that's like fall of 06 and 07, the year like I filmed the Super Unknown video, because a lot of the rails in the Super Unknown video are rails Hornbeck had shot in Salt Lake. And I was either doing different tricks or one-upping him. And that's where, like, the beef was.
Oh, damn.
But then he went back and did, like, the same tricks on the same rail with his pants rolled up to burn me, like all this crap. And like that kind of ended when we met, obviously, at like we met at the real time shoots and the Rage film shoots that year. And like obviously right away we were like, I don't know why we were beefing, dude. You're cool. Like you're also a skier. And we spent, I think that whole year of the real time shoots, I spent the entire month of like April and May, even though somehow I was in college at the time in Colorado, in Boulder, living with like wherever Hornbeck or Matt were crashing or staying like somewhere in Denver with Josh or somebody while we shot all the Echo and Eclipse stuff. Like that was in May or April. Like I was in college. How I got away with missing like 3 weeks of school, I have no idea.
Yeah,
but we kind of ended it there, and that from there we were pretty tight. Like I feel like I didn't see them again until like the urban trips the next year, but we kind of hashed it all out like right away. Like I feel like we never beefed in person. It was mainly just like talking shit to our friends about the other person.
And then kind of like maybe that Minnesota trip was the first time all three of them were to get together, and it was kind of like,
oh, it was
almost a reverse, like it was like an open kind. It came to be like a joke. It's like, oh, I'm gonna burn. It was like, you know, sit back to like the burning mentality, and they would like try to one up each other and like, you know, stare at each other on the landing or you know whatever it is. But it was like all fun and games then. Like it was just like certainly
right,
but still like a little. And then Wallace in his head would be like, oh yeah, you're gonna say that. Like I'm gonna show you. Or when Matt would do the same. Or
oh,
but
yeah,
it was all good. Like as soon as we all, I don't even want to focus on it as much as we have because it's all good.
It's so funny though.
No, but it definitely like was the era that year for that. And everyone's young and just freaking raw and hungry. Like it's just a different mentality than anyone can recreate now.
Like there were,
it sets the scene.
Trips where Hornbeck wasn't eaten because he was like trying to film more rails. It would skip meals and stuff.
Yeah, like, Berman went on trips with him. He ate like tortillas and hot sauce. He was making like $3,000 a year and was like
the two-pack diet.
Eating diet pills and I
green tea pills.
Green
yeah,
tea pills.
Like all these I hear skiers now like complain about like getting paid. Like I don't know. It's just like what those guys are making.
I'm only making like
nothing.
$30,000 this year. Oh, I can barely get by. It's like, dude, Hornbeck was straight up living, traveling for like
but
$3,000
like
grand a
working,
year.
Working man skier. Like he would go and work his ass off doing something in the summer.
Oh, yeah.
And always like, you know, his work ethic is why he is
made
where
it
he
so
is
far.
In life.
He's got a legacy. He's 59 years old and he's still out there getting it done, man, based on that history of being that blue-collar workman skier.
I heard he's going pro in motocross, though. He's making a switch. He's going Ricky Carmichael.
Maybe.
He better skip breakfast and stay hungry for that. It's the only way to get good.
Wally, what's your favorite trick from this whole movie? What's your favorite trick that you've got? I know that's a really tough question.
Yeah,
you can pick a couple if you want.
It's tough. I mean, obviously, like, the whole Wendell session is, like, a highlight experience of, like, that whole year and, like, one of the cooler, like, film experiences probably of my life. But I'd say, like, one rail trick, like, in particular is just that double line in Minnesota. Not the line portion, but, like, the two pretzel two and the purple hoodie. Like, that Kyle shot at night. It was like New Year's Eve and I had tried it all day. It's probably one of the hardest tricks or like the one that took me the longest or most amount of tries that whole year. And I just remember being like, it was the first year people were spinning on to kink rails and we thought we were just so ahead of the game. And
it
like,
was ahead of the time. Like
that was ahead of the game, yeah. Man,
like
straight up. Cause I remember.
Yeah.
Dude, Decker calling me either like during or immediately after and just being like, dude, you're not going to fucking believe what Wallace just got. And I remember just like fiending, like, I can't wait to see like what, well, no. I mean, he told me what the trick was. And it's like, wow, I think I can imagine what a 270 onto a dub kink looks like. But you sent it to me or showed it to me at some point.
And he wanted to do it. I remember like we went to that rail. It was like the perfect rail for it. And we were like nervous about getting kicked out. And then like some janitor came out, I think, and unlocked it for us. And was like, have a good time. And I remember being like, holy shit. Like, we kind of have permission on this rail. And I know it's just a matter of time. Like, Wallace was on this, like, grind that, like, whatever he wanted to do, he was just doing, as long as we didn't get kicked out. So I was like getting so excited. I was like, oh damn. And then it led to like doing a line into it. And funny, the
right,
yeah, the line into it, I remember like distinctly, we stayed extra. It was just him and I, and we stayed in some ghetto complex.
I thought we were going to die.
A mile from there. And there was like a shooting at a gas station outside of our hotel room. Barely slept at night. And anyways, we do it, hop in the car and drove straight back to Utah. You know, we had an air mattress in the back and just like pinned it back. Right. But it was that like wholehearted. Damn. It was Harding High School or middle school. Harding High School, I think.
Yeah.
In Minnesota. And it was just like, just
spot leak.
Two lines, yeah.
I mean,
everyone in Minnesota knows about it, but I don't.
I know.
Well, yeah, I mean, you turned that into your private little
rail park.
It was like your park rail, because.
Oh, I love that rail.
So that Two Pretz 2 is the ender of your segment in Turbo.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go back in 2010. For iTrip?
Oh, yep. Yeah. That intro line is too ignorant. I can't believe I said that.
But do you have anything to say for the people that want to come back here?
Don't.
They'd probably be a lot more kinder now and be like, yeah, come on out. Everyone should give it a shot.
Yeah, this is Tom Wallace checking in from xgames.com. The funny thing is that the 450...
I wasn't going to do that. I let you do that.
The 450 Pretzel 2 actually took like 25 tries, where the 2 Pretzel 2 probably took 125 tries
it
2 years
so
earlier.
So cold.
It was so much quicker doing the way harder trick 2 years after. I don't know if I got better or I got lucky, but it was... The 2 Pretzel 2 is still probably one of like the urban tricks I've done where like I really wanted something and I really, after doing it, thought I was going to like impress people, or it was like a pivotal moment in being like, I'm going to make it as a pro skier with doing shit like that. Like a moment where you really think back on it.
That was a thing, man. I mean, because I was so tuned in to what was going on, mm-hmm, and just like, I could not fucking wait to see that shot. And when I saw that shot, I was like, oh my God, there it is. That's it.
So funny.
So yeah, I mean, you were not the only one on that tip. Like,
and those
everybody else knew what was up to.
Those were the days where, I mean, you guys might remember more specifically, but I remember Berman trying to like explain to the sponsors, like, dude, this Tom Wallace guy. And there was like, even a couple years after that, like no one really...
Nobody really took the bait
until like he got that was back when you had to get competition results to start getting paid, but he was like still he was probably making like less than $10,000 that year and the following year.
Oh, yeah.
And like all of a sudden you win a competition and then your career takes off. But like
you win 15 grand in a day.
He proved himself like easily that year. So it was like, it's kind of funny looking back. I bet Berman could go into his sent out box, which we won't mention names, but like I remember him hyping him to people and being like, oh, there'll be another one of him, or like whatever. And it's like,
the only people that knew were the gibberish guys, because they sold out of that Oh Wow hoodie that you wore at the
Award. Yeah.
Oh Wow.
Oh my God.
Oh Wow.
I think it said Wow on it somewhere.
Yeah, it did,
but
Award, but they're like, Award hoodie. That thing was pretty lit.
That thing was sick.
Yeah.
I wish I still owned that piece.
They could do a re-release now and probably sell out.
Probably. I would hope.
Oh, yeah.
I'd buy one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you guys have that same oh shit feeling after the zero at Wendell's?
Oh, let's just talk about that session, man. That whole thing. Because that was, I mean, well, as you talked about that being one of the more memorable shooting experiences, and that for me was one of the more memorable shooting experiences to that point in my life.
That
is an indelible mark. Because just a little quick bit of history, I had always seen these insane summertime setup jumps and hood, usually in the Wendell's lane, I think. Mm-hmm. And they had this very specific step over style where people could go huge and impacts were kind of minimal. And it was a jump that I really hadn't seen anywhere else until we started building them based on those jumps at some of our park shoots in Colorado. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, like, they weren't anywhere else. And I forget how we got the connection to Tim Wendell, who obviously ran Wendell's camp at that point, and gave us the green light to come in and push up what was their camp jump and do like a revised version of it for our own purposes. And I mean, the stars absolutely aligned between just like a crew of uber talented, hungry dudes, the perfect jump that like nobody could get hurt on. And everybody's just like, every time you're dropping in, people are trying new tricks that they've never done before and just vibing.
And Henrik Harlow intro to the level one.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Yeah. I guess quite the mixture of people from like Rainville to Walsh and Henrik, I guess. So people you don't historically think of as being like nasty park jumpers, which Rainville certainly was in his day. But
That was the era when everybody in our crew still did park to some extent. Even like Wiley, for example. I don't know if he came to any of our park shoots, but he was going to TGR park shoots.
Yeah.
He was shooting street that year.
Oh, yeah. He hit a rail with me. I hit an urban rail with Wiley. Yeah. It was sick.
No shit.
Yep.
Yeah.
So everybody at that point hadn't, hadn't moved so far in one direction or another to the point where everybody in the crew, more or less, was invited to that Wendell shoot.
Yeah. And that was just on the cusp of the doors being just completely blown off the jumping bus, but you unlocked the dub on that jump.
Yeah,
that I almost think the zero motion zero was like a highlight of that section. But at the time, we knew that it was dope at the time. But I remember when you were going for the dub, that being even more crazy of how knew it was.
Yeah, that was like the scariest thing I had ever done in my life, for sure, up until that point. Like, before airbags, before foam pits and all this crap, I just remember, like, I think I had tried one earlier that year, like a Switch not Dub 9, but, like, that one was definitely, like, that jump was just so good, like Josh was saying, like, so smooth, so low impact, and I was, like, it was late in the day, I think, and most of the crew had left even when I tried that double. And I was like, I gotta try it. Like, I thought about doing it. I've seen people try something similar. But that was, like, right on the cusp of, like, when the double corks came in. And looking back on it, I rewatched that shot. I'm like, I didn't even come close to grabbing. Like, I didn't even try to grab.
No, didn't matter.
Wasn't a thought.
But the landing, pretty dope landing.
Boom.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was, that was more of a highlight. I thought the zero spin when I did it was kind of cool, and it's more memorable now. But like the feeling and the like anxiety and stress of going into that Switch Dub 10 for the first time was like for sure scariest thing in my life up until that point.
Totally, dude. I remember feeling that for you because I was filming the wide angle off the lip and you were like, I remember, I don't know, people had definitely left and you were like maybe having a solo session at that point. But it was like, you were all jacked up on vitamin B12.
Henrik gave me a bunch of vitamin B12s. I was vibing all night. I was firing.
Here, Wally, take these and hit the jump 250 times.
But I remember you being like, well, I'm going to go for this. I've tried it before. I don't even think I fully understood like how what a dub cork even looked like. I know you were scared, and I was like, just feel like it. I had the secondhand scaredness going on, you know? But so that to me was like the moment. But it's funny how if you don't know that and you watch that part now, obviously the zero spin is the more timeless maneuver that stands the test of time, whereas an ungrabbed dub, Switch Dub, just is like, oh, what was that?
Yeah.
it was smooth, though. It was smooth.
No, it was smooth for sure, but it's just like one's like, think looking back going
no.
Dub though,
was that your first time skiing with Henrik?
No, I mean, we had skied together that whole year. Henrik had lived in Salt Lake a ton with the 4x9 crew, and we filmed a bunch of like rails. He lived on our couch for maybe like 2 months in the winter. Somehow
he filmed a lot.
A 15-year-old from Sweden, and then he lived in Mount Hood with us for like a month and a half, and we lived with four dudes on bunk beds each, and Henrik sleeping on the couch in the Ark at Wendell's, which was like five total dudes in a tiny room with one bathroom. I don't know how we survived. Looking back on it, but me and Henrik like had skied together
cared.
A lot then. Yeah,
you were skiing in the summer.
We were
dude, Ark life in those days. That was good living though, man. There was a good energy there.
Oh yeah,
there was a vibe at the Ark
because
you had like the Heshers. That was when Hesh was going full blown in his snowboard world.
Yeah.
So those guys were like a few doors down, like burning pallets and ollieing over fires and stuff. And then you had like. Dude, the skier homie, yeah,
kids.
You and Henrik just holed up in that roachy ass room,
just watching ski videos at night and skiing all day,
and inhaling black mold probably. But yeah, I have those
lots of black mold
photos from that disposable I was looking through recently of you and Henrik in the largest t-shirt I've ever seen.
I know, I posted,
like,
I shared that one the other day.
8XL.
So
yep. Just geeking out, just watching shit back and back and back and back and back and forth.
Yeah. I mean, that session was definitely my first sunset shoot ever, for sure. And it was like
Dope. So
insane. Like watching the sun go down, and like Seo was shooting photos all that night, I think, too. And we had like shot urban stuff together. But like, I think everybody really left for the most part before it got like crazy golden. And like to this day, like, I don't leave a sunset shoot until somebody tells me to stop.
And that's back in when, like...
I learned my lesson that night. You stay, because it gets good.
Back when, like, getting... I don't even know how to describe it. Maybe you guys can do it more. But back when getting a photo meant so much more than it does today. Like getting it printed in a magazine was an additional goal to, like, filming a segment. I feel like I don't see that as much anymore.
No, it's definitely not so much of a thing anymore. I mean, there was a time where, for one, photographers were actually out there getting after it. I mean, I could list on one hand the photographers that actually came out and shot with us this year, or maybe even the total number of days that I shot with a photographer this year on one hand. But certainly 10, 12 years ago, that was the golden era of print as far as its representation in action sports. And that's where you're seeing a premium placed on photography, and the photographers were all working for it too. I mean, that was a really awesome time.
Even watching like Turbo and watching all the urban clips, like there's such
flashes.
A premium on photography. No, Hornbeck has goggles around his neck on every urban feature because he was trying to get incentives if he got a photo
that
published in
incentive.
Magazines.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like no one would do that nowadays because there's not incentives for magazines or whatever. Like Hornbeck's got goggles around his neck in every shot.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Like Hornbeck
doing
was
nothing
also
whatsoever.
Like
nothing.
And you would always like
Almet was on that same tip though.
These guys would be always doing like the most progressive at the time, most progressive tricks, and then you would always be like, okay, it's time to shoot the photo at the end, and it'd be like guy sliding down a handrail, because there was always the debate. The photographer would be like, the magazine doesn't run the tricks, but then vice versa. But it would always like, not necessarily always showcase the craziest action, but it would always be like, okay, we got guy on handrail, epic lighting, like print it. And I remember how exciting it was to watch, like wait for the magazines and be like, flip through them and be like, oh my God, there's that shot from so-and-so or.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why we need a level one print mag.
Yeah, well, I mean, going
just saying
that was the last mini mag we did for Turbo.
It was
and flipping through that. There's some amazing photos in that. But was it Seo that shot the Harding Dub Kink at night with you guys, or Austin Hull?
Austin Hull. I don't think any of those even ran.
Well, we put it in the inside cover of the DVD.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And it was an ad that year, but he got you like mid-2.7 on, which
like,
I always thought was a really dope photo. That captured. That was a lot more than just like a rail
dude on the rail.
Photo.
Yeah.
I specifically remember that almost being the one I was just referring to. I remember the magazines like for whatever reason didn't run it, and I was like kind of frustrated because that was so
cool.
I was just ahead of its time.
They didn't know what to do with it. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, Ski Magazine photo editors, I mean, no offense, guys, but they were never too
the most
savvy
progressive.
Or progressive when it came to street stuff.
Yeah.
Real quick, I just want to dive back into Henrik's first appearance with Level 1, because there's a funny back-end story there. So Mikhail Deschanel had been trying to convince me to invite Henrik to a park shoot for 2 years at that point. He first hit me up. He's like, yeah, man, this kid, he's 13 years old. He's going to be the fucking best. And I'm like, dear God, I am not taking responsibility for some 13-year-old that you're going to like put on a plane and send over here. And then I remember talking to him again. It's like, oh, Henrik, he's going to be the best. He's 14 now and he's doing switch 14s. And I remember like that was a thing he made like a point of. And I guess he was probably what, 15 the summer that he finally showed up.
Maybe 16 at most.
Yeah, something like that. But I remember hitting Mikhail up afterwards and just being like, yep, you're right. Yep. Anytime you want to send this kid over again, like I'll take responsibility. But there was definitely this thing where I was freaked out about the concept of accepting responsibility for somebody who would have been very young. I mean, all of us were young, right? But we're talking like late teens-ish, the early 20s, and having like a real legitimately like young...
A child,
prodigy, but a child hanging out with us. Like,
and doing like crazy tricks, like in a foreign country, kind of health insurance does he have? Like, liability.
But I felt, exactly. But I felt some kind of like role as this like dad to everybody. And it was like, you know, tough enough keeping the majority of our crew out of trouble and or safe, let alone you introduce somebody who's like really... a child. And it's just like, I can't do that, man. I can't do that. But yeah, Mikhail knew. I mean, straight up knew when Henrik was probably even younger than 13, because he didn't start bugging me about it until he was 13. But it's like, yeah, he is going to be the best. And
still what, 15 is the best.
Years later.
Did you see that Henrik and Mikhail are skiing together right now in Sauce Bay?
That's one of the reasons that it came to mind, actually. So it's just like Mikhail got back on skis.
Fuck yeah.
I bet Henrik's so excited. It's like he's been on top of the game for so long, but he is probably skiing's biggest fan. Like, I bet he's like, I can't wait to see what they end up doing.
That is one of the things that keeps Henrik on top, is straight up, you nailed it, Decker. He is skiing's biggest fan.
He knows every little
nuance,
how people like move their body in the weirdest ways. And he studies like what he likes, what he doesn't like. And he produces like his like hybrid of, it's so
of
good.
All of it.
And that we're lucky to have him still competing. Cause it's good to,
yeah,
it's good to see someone like that repping
and filming video parts.
Yeah,
like
the whole
enchilada. Oh my god. Before we go back to the street stuff, let's talk about the other park shoot segment in this movie, because it is stacked with new faces and just like heaters. It's like Eclipse Copper / Squad 2, like mashup of a bunch of different park shoots. But Duncan Adams, Justin Dory, Mike Riddle, John Brogan and Adam DeLorme all making appearances in just like a banger mixtape of a park segment. What were your guys' impressions watching that again?
I was like looking in the DeLorme and the Brogan. I think we talked about this, but there was a couple shots that wandered their way into the credits.
Yeah.
And I look back and I'm how did those shots get into the credits? I mean, I edited the credits. We were all equally responsible. When I look back, I'm like, those are some of the best shots in the movie. And I didn't realize, like, you look back and watch the Brogan stuff. And I mean, kids are still talking about John Brogan, and then DeLorme, no intro needed, Dory, Duncan. I mean, we were so lucky to, I feel like we were like, that was an insane lineup.
Yeah. That's the year Brogan won Super Unknown. And he came in with like the most ignorant landings for everybody, and I feel like brought like bit of like
repping
motivation,
all kinds of crazy cotton layers and chains and
so
goggles
sick.
And
he was 17 years old at the time, and he took like your afterbang
to the next
Lanny's
level
to like many levels beyond. I remember when that video came through, I don't even know if it's a super, it must have been a Super Unknown video, because Hornbeck we were all watching that stuff in the spring, and I was, it must have been, I don't know when it was, but Hornbeck was like, Frida, you ain't gonna like this. Because I think he thought that, like, I wasn't into that, like, almost forced, over the top.
It's pretty curated.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was definitely, like, by design, like, manicured. I'm gonna be... Dude, yeah. I'm gonna have the illest fucking also, way install this around.
Like the height, like somewhere around Turbo or Real Time was the height of like the ski gangster, like tall T, just like such a style that like, yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely, dude. Like that was like, I have in my notes, like setting the, you know, the era for 2008 here. I think that entire season, musical-wise, was like everyone was listening to Lil Wayne nonstop.
Yeah.
That's it, almost. Like, it was either Lil Wayne or MGMT. Like,
yeah, that
MGMT was probably the biggest band in the world. I remember being at a college party in Boulder. Probably Decker, you were there, Hornbeck, all those guys. And just having Time to Pretend. Like, it was on loop, dude, at this college party. And then, like, everyone's like, who's going to use this in their part this year? And it was in, like, four different video parts. And then, Lollipop was probably, like, hitting the charts that summer, 2008. But, dude, everyone was listening to Lil Wayne. Like, at that park shoot in specific, I remember, you know, everyone was rocking headphones, and it was just like
listening to the same
some not
song.
Even plugged dude. Into yeah. iPods, by the way.
Really?
Just straight up accessories.
And the other thing too is like, LRG. Guys, remember LRG being like the height of?
Oh yeah,
that was like had, popularity. I think Brogan was wearing a mix between LRG and maybe Gibberish for the park shoot. Was
oh,
it
no,
all
dude,
Gibberish?
Vanular was the big offender, rocking just like crazy Rasta LRG flavors, just like.
That was the year of that. I mean, was that not when the bird? What year was the? We're bringing the bird back.
That was that year. That was the Keystone shoot that year.
That was right
okay,
before
that's
the,
what I thought.
Right before the park shoot we're talking about is when we filmed the Gibberish edit.
I mean that edit defines that entire era, and it still does this day, and people still watch it to this day. To like
gunshots
that
and
is
claims,
what some
dude,
after
mad
band,
gunshots,
baggy clothes.
I don't think the bird ever left.
It didn't
that
go nowhere.
Park shoot was sick. I'm watching that random park collection. I remember the Rodeo 5 Berman on that squad jump that KO'd me on the side slip up.
Oh, dude.
Yeah.
So that whole squash shoot, that was a skull candy shoot.
Yep.
That was one of the few times early on that anybody listened to me when I was trying to wave your flag. Jimbo Morgan picked up on it.
Yeah, true.
Because I was just like, man, Tom Walsh. And Jimbo Morgan's like, all right, let's bring him out to this thing. And I remember at the end of that shoot, Jimbo just like, I don't know, like whether he put his arm around me or like punched me in the gut, one or the other. It was just like, Berman, yep, that Tom Walsh, yep. And and then the rest was history there. But I do remember bringing you into that thing as a complete wild card.
Yep.
And you shut everything down, and including yourself and your shoulder on...
Well, that was the first sign of some sort of non-invincibility.
Chink in the armor right there. It's like he's a human after all. He's not just some crazy skiing robot from the future.
The funniest part to me every time I see the clip is that I don't remember the Rodeo 5 because I knocked myself out 10 minutes later and I lost 20 minutes of memory. So I literally don't remember doing that trick.
I feel like
and it exists.
Yeah. Not only at that shoot, but like... throughout Tom's career, knock on wood, but like he never really got hurt doing anything
Why
he always got
careful.
Hurt. He would always get hurt like
doing still skiing over here. Be careful.
No, but for as good of a skier he is, he would always get like hurt doing like
stupid stuff.
Really simple things. And he didn't get hurt like doing his like
triple cork or whatever.
Crazy
that
thing onto a rail.
Collarbone too.
Yeah,
this one was the collarbone break, just side slipping a freaking jump. Like, what an amateur move.
Well, I just remember being down in the ski patrol office with you, and they were like, yeah, classic collarbone break. Like, he's fine. But you're frigged. You can't ski anymore. And I was like, how did this happen? What? We were just like about to tee off on the big jump up there. And then
that jump kind of sucked though. So it's probably better.
It was huge. It was crazy.
Yeah. And it was a step down, an 80, 90 foot step down. But then next fall at Dew Tour in Breck in December, you did the same fucking thing. Yep. Oh man, that was heartbreak.
Three collarbone breaks on the same shoulder in the period of like 9 months. Like, what are the odds? Should have gotten a plate put in there.
The odds are that it hadn't properly healed and you wanted to go skiing.
Yeah. Oh, that's too true. Too true.
Hungry.
Oh man. That Squaw Valley shoot, real quick. That was the first time that we crossed paths with Parker and CeeLo any kind of filming capacity. Borderline without realizing it, I actually had to do like a deep dive earlier this year looking for some old archival stuff of those guys, and like looking up their names, like found like Parker from that particular shoot. And again, that was through Jimbo Morgan.
Because
he was on the Skullcandy. They were on the Skullcandy program through Jimbo.
Them, right?
And so he brought them out. And yes, both of them at the same time and birthed them. You didn't know it was possible, but it is.
Damn.
I have no recollection of them being there because obviously
left no impression.
Well, I mean, it was like Wallace and Stefan and
Rainville.
Oh, yeah. It was like
all
plenty
the heavy
of these
hitters.
People that I was like busy filming and new and interested in. But I, years later, I've spoken to both Parker and Chris have brought it up with me, and they're like, yo, like, I think like we met you in Berman in like 2008, like at this shoot for something. They didn't really know what it was, but I was like, I don't know.
They were too young to even know what it was.
I don't know. And then they're like, yeah, we talked to Josh and he's like, you guys should like enter Super Unknown.
Good plug.
That's funny. That's what Parker told me too. It's like the first time we met. Cause he's like, yeah, like, how do I like film with Level One or something to that effect? And like, yeah, dude, like anytime somebody sends an email or comes up to you in person, it's just like, that's how you do it. Like, that's how we're going to do it. Otherwise, it's just like you're a friend of a friend and you just kind of come into the fold in a very organic way. But if you want to like,
don't tell people that. It's super unknown.
No. But I'm saying like, no. If you're going to like film with Level One, it either just kind of happens. Or for like people that want to like send in a resume or something, like the equivalent is applying to Super Unknown. That's definitely what it is because we're not like out looking. Yeah, apply.
That's our application process.
It's a very formal, resume. Super formal.
Make sure you have your LinkedIn profile dialed because that's going to be a heavy hit. Yeah.
We did add that to Super Unknown 2 years ago, Tom.
And no also way. Just write down in our list of all the tricks that you can do, all the tricks that you can do on a trampoline but not yet skis, and all the tricks that you want to learn.
On an airbag.
Yeah.
In alphabetical order, please.
Let's talk about a little bit about a Met segment. I heard
But Strings. Is that the track?
Yeah, like I was like really, really into like songs with strings back in the day. But yeah, that was nuts.
Violins hitting.
Violins and gangster beats. But Met segment. I've worked with him. I think at like a year or two prior to that, or I've kind of known him. First met him by messaging him on New Schoolers in like 2002 to be like,
no shit,
you got this backyard setup. I didn't even know he like brought AstroTurf to skiing. I was like, how are you skiing in the summertime? But anyways, he was like making these edits on these rails his dad built, but he has the smoothest style and like just best like style on kink rails, I think, because he's had so much practice and has that East Coast kind of that East Coast steez, and that's like his opening shot in Turbo, I think, is a good example of it.
Is it that Denver red kink row?
Was that like an 8 kink?
Yeah.
He does something different.
He slides that so smooth.
Like everybody balances with their feet, and somehow his like skis don't bend. Like they don't flop like up and down at all. It's his shoulders and his knees. Like his skis are just flat and parallel to the ground the whole time, and it's like, how are you doing? How do you stay on the rail? It's like unique to him. It's like pretty insane rail, like balance ability.
Yeah.
I heard you found some sort of animal at one of the spots there, Decker.
Yeah, there's I believe it's a quad king kind of in the woods in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. It's by the infamous East 99th and St. Clair that Bone Thugs raps about. But I went into the woods.
Of course.
Bone
Thugs plug.
A questionable neighborhood, and I went into the woods in the bottom, and I was like shoveling a spot, and my shovel hit something, and I was like, for some reason, I was like, that is bot. Like, it just felt like a body, and I was kind of nervous, like, what the hell is this going to be? But it was a pit bull that had been in some kind of a fight, and somebody just like thrown it in the woods, and that's just something I randomly stumbled across.
That is so disturbing.
Yeah, so
you don't see that in gated community.
No.
You don't see that at Vail Resorts, or they would clean that up.
Yeah, dead pit bulls and skiing don't necessarily go hand in hand.
But Ahmed was like,
I mean,
the year before that, I think he really made his name with his segment in Enjoy. And if no one's ever seen that, at the time, I think if you wrote down a list of like the never before, he was just like constantly doing a trick that kind of had never been done before. I feel like he was so advanced on his like technicality and style.
I'm pretty sure you can watch it on lafa.com.
Oh,
yeah.
You gotta be able to.
Yeah, and same thing.
Fam channel.
Same thing with like his level one segment. There's like so many like he does like so the uniques. Like he does a couple unique slides, but he like does it in like a steezy way. I know there's like some goofy ways to do like a broken grind or whatever, but he like really. He is so conscious and focused on style, and like that's he'll get a trick, you know, a couple times. And if it's not exactly how he wants it, he's the guy that's going to go back and do it, even though he technically on paper did the trick.
Yeah, that trick has so much style with the front, too. It's fucked. It's really ill.
And he's one of the funnest guys to like spend a winter with driving around, and the amount of ridiculous antics and like. Yeah, I mean, his personality is
highly entertaining.
He's just a highly entertaining, high energy, like, he's got good drive. And when he's in this, he's somebody that, like, he has such much work ethic that, like, you almost got to be like, okay, you're done with this rail. Cause somebody will not give up. Like, he will work as hard as he can until he gets what he wants. And he usually gets broke off, but man, he does not walk away from things. And he, if you look at his segments throughout the year, it kind of shows.
Any good shenanigan stories that are fair game for being shared at this point from traveling around with him and Hornbeck and Wally?
I can't specifically. I mean, there's just a lot of ridiculous little things he did. Nothing really stands out. Wallace might have any, but I might hold him back if it's like. I'm trying to think.
I don't got anything like that stands out like super funny. Was that the year we did the Mall of America Day in Minnesota with all three of us?
Oh, that was like a tradition.
That was every year.
We go to Minnesota
this
and
the
go
first
to Mall of America.
Experience at the world's best roller coaster theme park.
Ride roller coasters and I mean, we spent a lot of time in Minnesota, and I feel like Twin Cities.
I feel like we're gonna have funnier Met stories if we get a second guest appearance for when he first went to Finland. We'll save that for another time.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
That might have to be rated for the LaFa network.
That's okay. We can censor it.
Yeah. But yeah, really no intro with Ahmed. Same thing. Just like funny, full of energy, blast to be around, works his ass off, and has really damn good style.
I'm going to take that on a tangent
go for it.
So,
go for it.
Ahmed grew up in Western New York, upstate Western New York, and was part of the I Hate New York crew when they were in high school. And I met those kids, him and his brother, Ahmed and Garai, when they were at Vermont Open, like when they were 14, 15, 15, 16 maybe, chucking nines in the half pipe at Stratton and stuff. Just like, they had a super supportive mom that drove them around in a minivan to all these things around the East Coast.
Shout out.
2004. They freaked out, I think, because they couldn't hit this rail out of Free Skier Jib Fest 1 year, too. But just
bad vibes.
Good skiers from like super young age. But the other member, outstanding member of the I Hate New York crew is Will Wesson, who also joined the crew this year, like Level One crew this year. And he had made like two, at least maybe one and a half movies with I Hate New York. And that was with Andy Perry and Amet and Garay and all those guys. And they had a very famous backyard setup at the Dolly's household.
Oh, yeah.
But these guys are all like students of like the jib world, I guess. Like were obsessed with like, and I know Walsh, you guys were too, but they were on another tip. Like, yeah, it was like studious, like just full nerds on tricks and just elevating
nerds
themselves
on rails
in a different way than like the Burnham style. I think it was more like just, I don't know, like
they started the backyard movement.
Academic or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But Will got picked up and brought into the Meathead Films world, and he was in one or two of those movies. Meathead Films was an East Coast-based movie company that, I don't know, was doing a lot of stuff for the talent on the East, which we had since moved on from for the most part. But I saw Will's part in Wanderland, which came out in 2007. And it was definitely like baseball scout moment where I was like, ah, the kid on the farm team is playing pretty well. Gonna throw his name in the draft pick for next season. I was like, nah, there was no question. I saw Will ski and was like, you are coming with us, my friend. I had never met the dude, but I was hanging out with the Meatheads, like Jeff and Rooster. And I think Tyler Seacrest, which is another one of their homies from New York, that had gone to school with Will, and I was asking him about it. I was like, what's up with that Will Wesson kid? And Tyler Seacrest was like, ah, man, he's kind of lame, dude. He just, all he does is think about skiing 24-7.
Perfect. Like,
He's like, if you're driving around the car with him, he only listens to music from ski videos. he's only thinking about new tricks to do.
We like this guy already.
Yes. It was so funny. I was like, huh, noted.
I think rarely, this is kind of the exception of the rule, like rarely have we ever had conversations, Friedel, about, oh man, like this guy is killing it. We should like welcome him into the fold. Like that is not something that we've ever really done. And I actually remember sitting in my parents' living room in Vermont, because I think he'd probably come down from Burlington for a couple of days. I don't remember why, but I remember we were sitting there talking and you're like, yo, like this kid, Will Wesson, like, I think we want to like try to bring him in. And that was such a foreign concept to me. The idea of like, how does this work? Do we call him? Do we have to like, do I send him an Evite?
Right.
Like, what do we do here? But it was definitely like Friedel clearly had his finger on the pulse of what was going on. And, you know, I trusted everything that he had to say. So it was like, all right, like whatever this means, like let's do it. But straight up, like that came from you 100% as a fucking scout.
Yeah,
scouting.
That was a scouting moment.
And Friedel,
for sure.
Town scout.
I feel like for those of you that don't know Friedel certainly picks his battles or picks his times when he wants to speak up about something. So everyone in the crew always really, really respects his opinion because of that. So when Friedel's not like every day, like, you got to check out my buddy. But when,
my buddy Will.
So a man of few words.
Hell of a backyard setup.
When Friedel speaks up, it's like, you're going to, you know, it's
someone to listen to.
I'm very flattered. But yeah, Will, I mean, Will has been, it was a good draft pick because he's been like on a LeBron tip. Well, he's going like, how many years deep now?
This is 11, right?
No,
more than that.
This would be
13.
Oh,
yeah, this
movie?
Is the 13th.
He's still
no 13th. So yeah, this was eight.
So and he's been in every one.
No, this was
since.
Nine. Eight. Nine. Okay, so no, it'd be 11 years.
That's it. No, 12 10, years.
12.
Because count 10 years. 10 years after refresh, refresh would be 11th.
Absolutely.
This would be his 12th year. But yeah, he came out to
still a hell of a run.
My first impression of him, I think he had shot with you and Decker in Colorado before, but then he came out to Salt Lake where I was living that winter, and he came out for a week because he was still going to UVM, and I never met the kid, and he was really quiet, but I knew about him. I knew kind of like Jeff and the Meathead guys had kind of like filled me on what he was like. And I was like, yeah, he just is like, he always, you know, lives by skiing, obviously, but he knew all the spots and what to do. All he probably spent $15 the entire week he was there.
And he may or may not verbally communicate with you, but he's going to get a handful of bangers.
The night he flew in, I picked him up at the airport. We went to like Harmon's or something, the grocery store. He bought a bag of the generic brand Fruit Loops or whatever, like the store brand Fruit Loops, a huge bag. Like a the 2 jumbo foot size bag.
Family size.
And he put it up on top of Wiley's refrigerator, which is where we were staying. And that's all he ate. He'd come back, and it was kind of like an elevated version of the Tupac diet, where he was like, we'd come back from sessions, he'd eat a bowl of Fruit Loops, generic brand, and then like that was his dinner.
Yeah.
But he was, I mean, he immediately blew my mind, because he did, that's when he was doing the first version of the underslide.
Yep.
Yeah.
So we went to Rail Gardens, and he did that underslide back to out in that like famous Rail Gardens line. I think my lens was even starting to fog up at the time, but I was like, oh my God, there it is, the underslide, which he then won the award at IF3 for, the shot he got with
Meathead,
Shane McFalls and Meathead that ended their movie Head for the Hills, or one of that movie that came out the next year, that same year. But yeah, Will Wesson, baby.
Yeah.
I Hate New York. And a Met, of course.
Anything to add, you two?
Plenty you could get into about like Will Wesson, because he is such a unique person, but just a genuinely happy guy, but loves skiing more than anything. And recently I was glad to see, like the past few years, he seems to do non-ski travel as well, which is good. He used to be like, you know, he also, Henrik's the same way, where it's like, just
Henrik is the same way.
I remember definitely. Henrik was like on this program where he had to ski every day, even if it was like the summertime. Yep. But certainly all people that are extremely passionate about skiing.
And hopefully they listen to music outside of just ski movie soundtracks at this stage.
I don't know. I feel like by now there's enough ski movies that he could fill hours of ski movie music.
Henrik,
by now.
Oh yeah. Henrik knows as much about music as he does skiing, though. So he's way more advanced than any of us on that.
Another thing to add to Will, if anybody's ever seen his collection of handrails, like, his computer folders of photos in cities around the globe. Like, no one knows the urban planning of cities.
He also travels with a book the tricks he wants to do that season. It's like, I mean, I don't know if anyone's familiar with paper, but it's like he uses pen and paper, and he writes down, like, all these... I wish, like, when he's sleeping, I wish, like, one day I would, like, open up his book, his little diary, and open it... Because who the hell knows what's going through that guy's mind? Because he ends up, every year, he comes out with the
something.
I didn't know you could do that on skis trick. It's like, how many more of those does he have in him? But he still brings them out.
12 movies now he's been doing, I didn't know you could do that on skis tricks, and they still come.
He came back with a variation of an underslide this year on the same spot that he hit with Friedel first in 2008.
Ooh, spot leak.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Rail Gardens. But yeah, it's actually kind of crazy to think about it, that somebody could do something fresh in 2008 on a spot, come back 12 years later and do something fresh on that same spot, same person.
Insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Truly.
What would you do, Wally, if you went back to that Dub Kink line in Minnesota? Could you do something fresh?
I don't think the way I built my skiing in terms of technicality, I don't think I'm going back for an 8-10 on urban style.
Disappoint all the kids at home.
Back to Will Wesson
route.
You should totally. You guys should make a contest and see if a kid, because everyone knows what Rail Gardens looks like and knows this like setup there. have a contest if anyone can try to figure out what Will did, because I can't.
I can't. There's no way I can.
It'd be interesting if somebody actually could figure out what he ended up doing.
It's a subtle variation for sure, but definitely
new shit.
We did talk about going back to Harding this year while we were in Minnesota filming with Hornbeck and Casaubon.
Oh,
and
man.
Mostly filmer guy wanted it to happen more than anyone.
I think I would have been let down knowing that 32-year-old Tom couldn't keep up with 22-year-old Tom.
You should have done two Pretz too, for old time's sake.
That would have been easy.
How many tries would it have taken you, though? What was it? You said $125.
I think I could have done it within 10 these days, at least.
Would have been a midlife crisis. If it was
there you go. 32-year-old Tom.
Oh, man.
In it still.
Oh, that still was in it.
Another little story, not to go on a tangent, but every time we'd go to a spot with Ahmet and Hornbeck, there would always be, like, I could name some movies. I don't think it was started in Turbo, but those guys would just, like, stop, and they'd be like, all right. Here comes Tom with his little his crazy trick. That's Hornbeck voice. But they would make bets, and we would all make bets from the time he gets on the rail and gets to the end. That counts as his first try. Speed checks don't. How many times did it take for his crazy trick? And, like, surprisingly, it was pretty low numbers. I don't think he ever really let the number down.
Oh, yeah.
And I would kinda always, like, try to beat all the bets.
Tom to, like, he liked that kind of pressure to be like, oh, I'm going to burn you. I'm going to do it in 8. You say 10, I'm going to do it in 8.
Who would have thought I'd end up being a competitive skier in the crew who went on to do a bunch of competitions?
Good point.
Always just a little too competitive.
Yeah, yeah.
It takes you places.
Yeah.
I guess.
There's no shame being competitive.
No.
Till you're getting into a fight over beer pong or something, then it's a little far.
Yeah.
It's also like back to Henrik.
You didn't go to timeout.
Back to Henrik, it's like when you see somebody that crushes it so hard at filming, and I mean, I remember back then seeing a Tom, everyone is rooting for Tom when he was competing because he's like, that's our, like, film guy that's, like, out doing the comp. Because most, you didn't really mix both worlds, and everyone would kind of get behind him because he's, like, the dude. Some of those years, I think it was maybe not Turbo, but the following year, Refresh, he shot handrails and then went in one do tour, and that took off your career. But, like, and Henrik does.
Henrik's like the only guy now doing it.
I saw Henrik the night of X Games this year, at X Games in the Athlete Lounge, and he was changing and going to shoot a handrail in Boulder that night. Like, it's just something about seeing people doing that, like, adds a whole nother level of respect. So there's no shame in the comp scene if you're doing, you know.
No, definitely not. I think 2008, though, sort of thinking out loud, was probably right around the time when people started to go different directions. Because I definitely know that early on, and certainly into the mid-2000s, the best skiers were filming and competing, no questions asked. And in fact, looking at Turbo, Justin Dorey and Mike Riddle, for example, who were definitely pushing into the contest scene. I mean, that was the direction that they went rather than really pursue filming as a career path. And, you know, those guys through Dinastar at the time had a connection to us and they came out to the park shoots. And yeah, but that was definitely like the fork in the road. And you were one of the few, Wally, who, like, you know, kept that flame burning for a few years.
What year did you win X Games?
2010 in Europe and 2012 in the US.
That was the one, it was at night.
Yeah, the one at night. I was thinking too, like, with Rainville opening the movie and, like, all of his POW stuff, like, he still won Vermont Open in 06, 05. Like, he was a full, not a comp jock, but a full doing competitions. Like, and how much old...
He was in X Games.
Like, so many of those guys were all competition and film. And, yeah, I think, like, it ended at me. Like, I, like, became popular because I was doing both when 06, 07, it divvied and it kind of went both ways. And, like, I was, like, one of the only guys at that time doing both, which helped me a ton. I mean, even that year, like, filming, like, POW jumps before I went to Dutour and, like, getting coerced into... making deals that I had to buy a snowmobile if I won, and then I ended up winning, so I had to buy a snowmobile. Started my backcountry career.
The the filming gave you the street cred and made you the fan favorite, and the contest made you the sponsor's favorites and got you paid.
And the household name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that comes with, like, yeah.
Yeah.
All wrapped up in one for sure.
That's true. But the repetition, like the film repetition, like you don't practice like in the park like you do on a handrail. You don't hike the rail 100 times. You'd look like an idiot if there was a chairlift and you were hiking a rail 100 times. But it teaches you something about patience and balance and determination and perseverance and good practice.
Yeah, if you hit a gnarly urban feature and then all of a sudden you go to this perfect park at a contest, you're like, oh, this is... It's like, this
let me go.
Got all my tricks.
Yeah, let's go.
I just tried this 2-press 2 125 times in Minnesota. I can do it in this park with my eyes closed. Now true. Pay me.
And it's at night. I've been skiing at night for a month straight. None of you guys ski at night, so I win.
Yeah, there you go.
Half of you guys don't even know how the right goggle lens is. Clearly, never done this before.
Hornbeck and Amet.
Hang that shit around your neck.
I think Casaubon too. Hornbeck, Amet, and Casaubon. Just so like, I want to like get my tricks in the day. Like some. It kind of sucks skiing at night with these like lights flashing in your face. I remember Amet was the first to fall out of it. Hornbeck first thought it looked dope, and now Hornbeck's like, I'm only skiing in the daytime. Like, let's get up early, let's get it done. But in reality is you're gonna get more shots at night because you're not gonna get kicked out. But
I love skiing at night.
The vets are kind of like the vets are kind of like, I don't know, let's just ski in the day. Let's get up early and get it done.
Yeah. Oh, I back that program. I back that program 100% because you know what? Then we don't have to set up lights. And yeah. Dude, that's like half an hour on the front end, an hour on the back end, or vice versa.
But
man, if that's like an hour and a half more that you can sleep at night, done.
How much
deal.
More fun is it though, Josh, to stay up all night and then you don't have to set up lights at 6 a.m. when the sun breaches up above the horizon?
This is true.
What session was that?
We've done that a bunch.
Well, I know
the main one is for Sunny, I think, in Alaska that we did that.
Alaska.
That was insane.
Oh my god! Like taking naps in the car for like 45 minutes
chugging
in between
monsters.
Spots, so we could just go around the fucking clock. Like, woo.
And that Ogden rail.
And the Ogden rail.
I forgot about that one.
That was
not there anymore. It was taken
out.
Yeah,
I heard. They, yep.
The Gagne quad's gone?
It's still called the Gagne quad somehow.
Yep.
I still call it the Gagne
quad. We'll get to that
quad.
One next episode.
Oh, true.
But that was one of two like solid 24-hour film days, maybe three that I've ever had, where it was just like, because if you remember, like we got up like pre-sunrise to go up. We're going to try to shoot backcountry and then rescue the sled.
So
it's like Hornbeck sled died or whatever. Oh yeah.
And then finished at 3 a.m. on a quad kink in the pouring rain and
oh dude. And we Ogden. I've never been so happy in my life. That was the best. Let's spend another hour doing cutaways. Just like drenched to the bone.
The cutaways were sick though, throwing skis
absolutely.
Around.
Absolutely.
Well,
no, 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 dude. I was down to keep going until sunrise at that point.
Well, that was Wallace's thing, I feel like.
Cutaways.
He would get like a banger and he'd be like, all right, let's get some cutaways. Like, because it used to be about these like.
I'm working for it, man.
Gangster
working for
cutaways
it.
And like.
That is so true.
You got to support the
I
action and build
that.
The story, build the character.
The one. Real street trip I did with you, Tom, was that for
Quebec
refresh
one.
in Quebec, which was a good trip. But I remember that under the bridge, underpass wall ride.
Yeah.
You got that right side, like 180 switch tree out.
Yeah, five.
And then you're like, I was like, yo, can I get a shot of you like just for the in run dropping into that thing with it? Because the sun was like golden hour. And you're like, hell yeah, dude. Like, you're like, I love shooting these cutaways because that means I got something sick. I was like, damn, that's kind of true.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, man.
That, and you know what?
It's fucking true, dude.
You know what, though? That and that 4-second action shot plus a bunch of cutaways and all of a sudden you're
you got a whole
like
segment
90
coming along.
90 seconds of action that you shot turns into a 4-minute part.
Yeah.
Tom's problem
is... sponsor's paying you for that whole 4 minutes.
Tom's problem is he gets so many shots, you can't use cutaways.
I know. That was a problem at that point. But I'll tell you, man, like, we're dealing with it this year. Like, some writers and some filmers shoot zero cutaways. And I'll tell you what, like, all the B-roll...
is so
not nice. Only, like, paints a picture, tells a story, lets you, like... put a face to this, you know, athlete. It
makes it more kind of ski porn.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it gives you as a viewer some kind of connection to the athlete themselves, because trying to put together a part that is simply action based, man, even if it's really awesome action, like, it's just like a little, like, it's a dude moving on a screen.
Gives you flexibility as the editor to, like, make it unique to whatever song you didn't know you were going to use. And all of a sudden you can craft it the way you want it. Otherwise, it's just like shot.
100%. But I think that is a detail that's lost on so many people on both sides, is that, you know, the aspect of filmmaking here, you know, certainly comes into play. And it's the writers that understand that, and it's the filmers that understand that decide to actually work together and do a little extra beyond just the action. I mean, those are the success stories. And I think... Walsh, I mean, you can certainly speak to that, because you've known that and picked up on that and worked for it since day one. And that's a big component. That's such a big component. And, you know, I think we already talked about it last week in the real time episode, just the fact that, you know, one of the first shoots that we ever had with you at Copper, that log stall where it was like everybody else left. It's this, you know, kind of mediocre...
It was not a great feature.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. But all of a sudden, the lights started to pop, and it's like, and Seo probably said, this is going to be an amazing sunset. Let's shoot this. Like, I've got 45 flashes. And it's like, all right, game on.
Master of the flashes.
Dude, I mean,
I think he only had 28 flashes.
Okay.
Sure. Six of them
I stand
working.
Corrected. But, but either way, I mean, like, case in point, like, just, you know, understanding how that whole process works and putting in, I mean, it wasn't even a little extra effort. That was a lot of extra effort, because you've probably been shooting since 10 in the morning and, you know, everybody else was gone, but you kept it going. And that shot,
got a cover
or like
of a
several different shots.
Several.
It was definitely one in Scandinavia. It was one in Japan. It was probably one in the US. And then it was a bunch of editorial stuff on top of that too. And it's like,
who knew?
Working for it, man. Like, the people that really, like, understand how the process works and put in the extra effort, it pays off.
I think I just listened to people too good. Seo kept, he was bossing me around. He told me to keep hitting it, so I kept hitting it.
Yeah.
that's a very...
I was scared to tell him no. I was scared to tell him I was tired. No. I mean, I obviously wanted to keep skiing, but I just... He said it was good, so I trusted it, and it paid off.
Yeah, that shit all comes down to trust. If you have like some wacko being like, "Yo, hit it again," it's like, dude, are you even getting the shot? But
when some dude's got 24 freaking flashes set up, I'm fucking hiking back up there again.
Yeah, for sure, man.
And
it was
for
Eric
sure.
Seo, like, he's like, was like, that was like, he was getting a ton of stuff published the year before, so it's like.
Oh dude, man. He was like so on point.
He was
point.
Like the guy at Park Shoes in Urban. He's like, I'm gonna get a shot with him for sure. You shoot with Seo back in the day,
when
magazines were publishing a ton of ski photos.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was like you were gonna get. It was worth it working with him, because
A-lister, 100%.
Yeah, killing it.
He was on the trip with us this year too. The whole crew.
Yeah,
Except there are no magazines left to run the photos in.
Nope.
Level1.com Productions.com.
I mean, he could give it to me. I'll tag him on Instagram.
LaFamChannel.com. Also,
we haven't talked either about Hornbeck's seg or the Quebec seg in this in depth, but obviously, you guys being back in the streets with them this year, what was it like watching those old clips?
I mean, me more than anything, the Hornbeck stuff was. Me and Kyle were talking about it even before we started. Like, that segment gets slept on. It's like, Powell, Urban, everything, and something that like no one does anymore that I would love to see more of, like the general overall I can do anything skier, and that's almost like the best version of that segment. I forgot
one of his
about
best
it
segments. I forgot I thought the sunny I thought that Sonny was like his best. And then I look back and I'm like, no disrespect, because I think, but that could have easily been an opener closer for even that movie or like any, it was so.
It totally could have.
He really wanted it all. And he, that's so much work. And just knowing that he did all that on the shoestring budget he had. And he just like, I mean, it's easy to do that if you're like well supported, but like he took so many sacrifices to make that happen for his love for putting together a segment and just like the friendships I think we all have grown through that is like, it's such a awesome process. And he's a perfect example of somebody like you work hard at something, you're going to see good results. And he's still doing that. Like, with whatever he's doing, you know, like being a dad, being a skier, being like a, just at work, like he really truly is your blue collar, like work hard, get shit done, always positive. Like he's the guy you want on any trip. Yeah. Like
you were, I mean, not to keep blowing smoke up everyone's ass here, but you were like, I think Kyle, you were definitely his like, a huge Hornbeck supporter, and I think that's so crucial and sometimes how people get overlooked or swept under the rug if they don't have somebody like
waving their flag.
And I think when you officially like were with Level One, I mean, like somebody like Walsh, you were taking care of yourself for sure. It was happening. But but like Hornbeck, I mean, it was like he needed I think he would have been slept on in general, like, if it hadn't been for, like, somebody like Kyle just being like, dude, we need to film with this kid. We need to, like, give him every opportunity as possible. He doesn't have any budget or anything to make it happen, but, like, let's make it happen for him either way. I remember we were up shooting that big-ass jump at Eclipse that year. And, Decker, I don't think you were there. Maybe it was Berman and I.
We were real-time here.
No.
Oh. No. The huge jump at Eclipse.
Yeah, that crazy
Hornbeck
rodeo
got
nine.
This,
yeah.
He got this huge rodeo nine. And I know I was shooting the upper angle and Josh, you were shooting the landing, but I think we came down and I remember talking to you, Kyle, on the phone and you were like, Hornbeck get any shots? And you know, you were looking out for him, dude. And
he's
I was like, matter of fact, he did, man. He got one of the illest shots of the day, hands down. Like, it was nasty.
Massive.
And you were like, fucking great to hear. love it.
Thinking about what you just said, it also goes both ways. Like, I think there's this unspoken thing where, like, skiers just can get further if just when the filmer sees them put forth the extra effort and they're just enjoyable to be around. Of course, I'll be like, oh, I'm going to get Hornbeck on the trip. It's just like an organic thing. It's not even like a politic thing. It's like Hornbeck's always available. He's always down. He works hard. Like, boom. It's like there's not like a, oh, what sponsors does he have? Or like, it's just like,
right.
I just like.
What's he going to do for me?
Yeah. It's just like we work well together. Like, I don't want to work with somebody that like, there's just this respect you build more and more throughout the years. And you understand their limits, your limits, and just like, I don't know. It's my favorite part about shooting skiing is like, there's like a weird relationship you have with the skiers that you can't really describe. But like, Tom, for example, dude, like I know everything about him every time we shoot. It's like a marriage, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. For sure.
It's like a team.
Yeah.
It's I love the whole team camaraderie between the skier, the filmer, the photographer.
Knowing the nuances of what everybody does.
The guy who builds the park shoot.
Oh, yeah.
The park builder that built the jump. There's like, it's such a crew effort. Obviously, the skier is most important part of that element, but like, it's like.
Hornbeck's a great example of somebody else that like brings up and brings out the best in the other skiers around him. Like, I feel like every trip we've ever been on, I'm like kind of done. I don't really want to try something harder than what I tried. And he's like, what are you doing? I know you got that 450 in there. I know you got this or that. And I'm like, shit, you know, I think I was thinking about it, but I don't want to do it. And he's like, you won't. Come on, let's go.
Yeah, that's coach.
And then like,
that's coach home.
I end up getting a shot that I didn't think I was going to try. And it's
and then Hornbeck will like figure out who Tom isn't. Or he'll be like, oh, so-and-so's, I heard they're about to do like. He'll just still get under you and like a...
But he brings out the best in me every time we shoot together. I ski better, I try harder, I do better just because he's there.
It's, you won't.
You won't. I Dude, bet you that, won't. That,
those two words have made so many things happen over the years.
And how many shots in the movie were that? You won't.
Yeah.
Him and I would say there's a lot of the guys there also. Him and Wallace are another version of this, but they know how to like pep up people's, like, if you're down and out and you're like hiking a feature and like Hornbeck would have like a little rut in the landing. Wallace is a dude, no matter how tired he is, every single time, I'm going to make this landing perfect for you. And I feel like Hornbeck is always doing that, no matter how tired he is. He's like shaping lips or doing anything as a team to like, he wants Tom or wants a Met or whoever it is to like get the better shot. It's like, he's working for that shot just as, you know, like, that's, it's like, he's a team player.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's fucking crucial, because that shit weeds itself out if you're not.
Yep.
And I think at the risk of being a pessimist, I think that's where we're, like, something is being lost there in the era of social media when there's still so much fucking awesome skiing and ski projects out there. But as Instagram has put a damper on people coming together and building team energy into what they're doing, because everybody's got their own feed and everybody's looking out for their own clips.
Yeah. More so than ever.
Yeah. Well,
it's kind of depressing.
Yeah. No, I hate to say it, but it, like, I hope people listening can take something away from how much you can gain from working in teams. Yeah.
Yeah.
True that.
Yeah.
Word.
Amen.
Squad up.
Well,
get your crew together.
Squad up. Yeah.
There's still a lot to touch on here that we could talk about, but we're we go deep into it here. How are you guys feeling?
Pretty good. I don't know. Just rattle off some things. Let's see what sticks. If there's anything else that like super compelling that needs to be addressed.
I think we would be amiss if we did not discuss
Chewie.
Chewie. Let me bring Chewie back up, because where I was going that with was the Quebec session on the Red Ledge, which is a legendary feature. And JD does both switch lips on that. And that just made me so... It put my jaw on the floor.
He did both twos on a steep green rail. I forget where that was at.
Mm-hmm.
And she cut me.
Yeah.
You shot that, Freedom?
I did, yeah. I came into... Well, that was in the early winter of 2007 going into 2008. Quebec was having an all-time snow year. There's over a meter of snow on the ground. It was insane. In early December. I think I went up there December 8th, met up with JF Hool and JD Zcat, and then we just shot nonstop until Christmas. But if you know about entering into like the French Canadian Quebec street scene, it's like a whole different, it's a totally different tip. Mm-hmm. But those guys are passionate in like a completely different way. Very similar to what Wallace and Kyle were just discussing, but very fucking passionate for sure. JF Poole
in particular
is a very passionate individual. He wears his emotions on his sleeve and fucking gives it hell.
Mm.
But that was a pretty productive trip for sure. It was in a really fun trip. I ended up being a whole segment, but the Red Ledge is obviously an iconic spot. JD crushed it for sure. And JF got switch tails over to switch.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Fakie and two sevens fakie. I also remember at that session, my one big takeaway was that my French was getting better, because I took a little French.
Oh, yeah?
So JF Hool, I spent some time with his family in Drummondville, Quebec, and those guys are very French Canadian. No English being spoken in that household. So I had to like start speaking some French. And I remember I dropped some line after one of those guys at that Red Lead session, and JDZ guy was like, Fido, your French is getting good, man. I was like, your pronunciation is getting good. And I was like, damn, that feels good to hear, man. That's like better than like any other compliment you can get. Like, oh, but yeah, that was the one and only time I shot the Red Ledge, and it was pretty good. And JF also got like a 450 on to
down flat down, down flat disaster. Down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that trip.
Yeah, the ender in that segment.
And it was also notably the first time that we filmed with Phil Casabon in any like proper fashion. We were at this
blue downrail
in Messier, Quebec, and JF was like, "Yeah, Phil Casabon's going to join us," and he was like Armada Grom at the time that we knew about. He wasn't like a complete unknown, but he fucking ripped that thing up, and he did still to this day like a pretty nasty tail pressed fakie on it.
Yeah,
like and,
holds water.
Yeah.
So
similar to the Wesson underslide clip, in that he has a pretty nasty, maybe similar-ish trip. Anyway, that like there's some sick parallels between the two of them getting signature tricks and still being in the streets doing them to this day.
Somebody to really. And I mean, I was just gonna say.
Well, what I was gonna I'll just finish that thought. What I was saying is like similar way to Will Wesson getting scouted. I guess I had filmed the session with Phil, obviously, and immediately it was like, you know, catch my eye there, and he made it into the movie. But he came out with an edit that fall of 2008 called "Be Dawn, God and Wild."
Mm.
Watched it was like fully to this like Red Man soundtracks, self-edited, and immediately watched that and was like, yeah, let's fucking go. And it was a little more of like a warm-up program than Will had, because he had filmed that one rail session with us and made it into Turbo. But I it was like so night and day. Like, you like, I cannot stress how much I want to film with this guy. So going into the year of Refresh,
oh danger,
Phil Casabon was like the number one draft pick, and yeah, for sure
that shit worked out.
Yeah, what were you gonna say, Kyla?
Dude, so we're talking about all these like long lasting dudes that are still hitting hard. J.F. Hoole, when I was like a little kid in Ohio, I was watching edits of him crush it in the streets. I feel like he's consistently hit handrails longer probably than anyone else in the game every year.
It might be
for over 30 years.
I mean,
man.
Look at his like X Games real street was ridiculous. And he was like, that's like year like 45 on him just going ham.
Yep.
And he's another one like that is just like one of those guys that is still skiing, like him or a Tanner.
Such
or
a
Sammy,
hard worker.
Like, they just
such a, like,
work so hard and just so passionate about skiing. There's a reason why that the people that are still in the game are still going that hard. Like, a lot of people go other directions, but the people that are extremely passionate, like the Henry Carlos, the Tom Walsh, the Tanner Hall, the Jay, I mean, you could go on forever, but it's like pretty obvious that it's pretty sweet to see those guys.
JF never got soft.
Yeah. No. I think I might have mentioned this in a prior podcast, but he sent me his promo video trying to get signed on to Spy in 2003.
Oh, yeah.
And was like a standout. And again, like he and Charles Gunnar were the first two dudes I signed on that program. And yeah, I mean, dude is still riding hard today.
His segments in those Playhouse films from like way, way back in like 04, 05 or like before. Oh,
hungry. He still skis like he's a he still skis like he's like trying to get like a super unknown at it. He's like so hungry, dude.
Hey, JF, every shot, enough time has gone by, you can enter. It's cool, man.
He pours his heart and soul into everything, and it's like
he needs
pretty fun
needs
watching
to feed
him.
He's hungry.
Oh man, I did want to talk really quick about just growth of the business on that side of things, and you know, obviously we talked, Decker, about bringing you into the fold, which is a huge deal.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, cannot have this conversation about Turbo Year without bringing up Shuey Bauman, who came over as an intern from Germany. Because at that point, our summer internships were, I don't know, really, really touch and go. But it was a situation where, you know, we didn't have much to offer. It's not like we're like, hey, you know, random people, come be an intern for level one and put yourself up in Denver, Colorado, and just figure your shit out. It was, hey, you can come kind of live with us in our house office place building.
Ski fraternity.
In our frat house.
Yeah, you had to vet a roommate.
Yeah, well, yeah, but we really didn't. More so in this situation than any other, because Shuey, of course, comes to us from Germany. And
we vetted him.
Did we, though?
Yeah.
I mean, from a skill set standpoint.
No. From a personal level.
How?
Because he had his blog.
I know, but that stuff weirded me out.
Yes, I know. And that's what I remember. Because you were like, because obviously Kyle and I were both living at the house editing too. And that was the first year in the new, bigger downtown Denver house.
My bunk
bed. You were like, check this dude out. Like, is this like cool, or like, is this dude going to be legit to have stay with us for for 6 months? Like, you were vetting him for sure beyond his work.
It was as best we could, though, because either way.
Oh, obviously, as best you could. But it's like, you're looking for like red flags.
For sure. But this was did not speak to him on the phone, yeah, on Skype. Dude is from Germany. He's flying over here. Never even seen him before. Gonna go pick him up at the airport. Hope it fucking works. And I think we talked about it. Like, what is a worst case scenario if this dude gets off a plane and he just sucks? It's like, well, I think we just need to tell him, like, if that is the case, like, I will have to man up and tell him he has to go home. And that's like what we're gonna have to do. Like, I don't think it'll come to that. But yeah, I mean, it was such a wild card because yes, I read through like pages of his blogs and his like reviews of some weird art shit, and like, you know, obviously his resume and all his like work samples, he was way overqualified. It's like, clearly this guy's going to come out and can crush it for us, but he's also got to share a room with Decker, and they got to figure out what settings to put the fan on when they're sleeping.
So, I mean, this is like all of this. I don't know if anyone's listening. I didn't realize it as much until after I wasn't, but like, level one, like, I would explain to people, like my family, like, yeah, these are like my best friends, and I live down the hall from where my office is, and I live with my boss and my coworkers. It's like, people would be like, what? But it's like, truly, it's like a family. Like, Josh has a house, and everyone lives in the house, and the edit, it's the second house he's been at. Now they have an office, they've grown up, but like, you're like part of this like crazy, like, you're eating, it's like family dinners. We're gonna make like, Frito would make tuna melts, but everyone had like a roll. It was like this, like, sure. I don't know how else.
Best tuna melts out.
But like, production companies don't work like that. It was like, looking back, I thought it was normal, but now you look back and you're like, that's pretty crazy. Like, you know, it's pretty unique. And I think that's why level one had such a tight knit community. And like, athletes would come to town to be like, oh, we're hosting Will Wesson or Wiley. Let's take them and hit the town. It's like, it was like so much more than like a production company with an office. It's like this community. So yeah,
it was a family straight.
So
up.
It's like, you're bringing in this adopted kid. You're like, I hope this kid works out. And then Shuey worked out good. Real damn good.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because at that point too, like, we were just starting to sell a little more merchandise, which became an increasingly big part of our program. And we'll definitely talk about that more in future episodes, because I think there's some interesting stuff to share on that side of things. But like, at that point still, you know, intern's job was to pack and ship. It was the Gibberish collabs and maybe like a couple other random things that we were selling, and take them to the post office every day and go wait in line. And Shuey's like, fuck this. What is wrong with you people? There is a better, more German way to do this. I'm getting like one of these automated stamp postage meters, and I'm going to like streamline this and this, and we're going to like alphabetize and put these, you know, your stock in size order, and we're going to keep an inventory and all these things that, holy shit, how are you guys not doing this on your own? We're like, and so, yeah, inviting him or having him involved in the whole process was a major turning point just on the back end of the just running the business side of things and allowing us to take some of those next steps. And yeah, and then of course not to forget his contribution on the design and motion graphics side of things, because clearly that was where his interests were lying and his forte, and having somebody in-house that could really, you know, step our game up was huge.
Yeah, well, he picked up where Ben Woodworth left off, which is where graphics were, and motion graphics and After Effects was starting to, like, tie the movie together more
and
so.
And then Ben picked up where Neil had left off. Yeah, so, yeah, true. We were definitely recognizing that was an important thing. Whether, you know, on purpose or not, it just was gravitating in that direction.
Yeah, it just adds a level of professionalism to a movie project.
And, so many little loose ends that you can't describe that Chewie helped really tighten up the ship.
And German efficiency.
Allowed Berman to actually go out and shoot, because like the first couple years I was working for Level One, Berman just like trying to run a business, and you know, like there's so much getting sponsors and everything. And I feel like once Chewie came on, Berman was able to travel more and like trust that he could leave this random German guy and keep the company going.
Chewie's obviously been with us for a long time and is an amazing friend. But the very first impressions were funny because he was doing blogs. Blogs in 2008 were pretty hot.
Yeah.
And we used to have a Level One blog based on every trip we did. But he had the Mile High blog where he would talk every day, like writing home to his friends in Germany about his like impressions of the United States, and we would read these things because we were like in these stories. It's like,
what, and then Friedel did this.
Yeah, like what did he think about this party? Like, what did he think about this like place you went to? Like
that. What whole, did he think about these tuna melts?
That whole summer was like Chewie's American experience for sure.
And my roommate Kyle will not turn the fan off, and I can't fucking sleep.
Yeah, he hated the fan. My first impression or like memory of Chewie was I got picked up in Denver by Decker and Chewie at the airport, and I guess somebody had told them that I was watching the Euro Cup, like the UEFA Euro Soccer Cup was on 2008 that spring, and he's like, I heard you've been watching the Euro. And I like just met the guy, and I was like, yeah, I've been watching. He's like, yeah, my boy. It was like almost like a Borat moment or something.
And Berman's like, every 4 years nothing gets done in the office. It's just constant soccer
it's
watching.
True. Yeah,
it's true. Oh,
yeah, the World Cup in particular puts a damper on June.
Productivity.
Early part of July. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, it really was a very interesting and awesome dynamic to have all of us kind of living and working together. And I think we were all young and green enough at that point and excited about the idea of living in this huge house pretty much in downtown Denver, which was a really new and exciting thing, especially coming from the suburbs, which sucked.
Yeah.
And yeah, it really was a breath of fresh air as far as like this working environment. And it's like, man, it's like this is a real space. We've got a bathtub that we can put all our camera packs and gear in.
And your office
really growing up.
The office was a bedroom that didn't have a wall into the bathroom, and it had the bathtub. It was like, but it was still we had a. Yeah. It was that was a cool, certainly a cool.
It was
time
tight quarters.
Life. Yeah.
Especially with hot computers, it was borderline like a little sweatshop.
For sure. The other funny thing at that point, too, just on a technical level, is this was before we really had wrapped our heads around the idea of servers. So we're all editing off of separate hard drives.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, dude, I'm going to work on this person's part. And it's like, all right, dude, hand me that hard drive. And we're just like passing these things around the office. And it was this like, musical hard drive situation, which we started to solve the next year by putting everything on a rated server for refresh, which was a big step because we're like, this is not working. And I wonder if that actually came from Chewie.
Yeah, for sure.
Probably. I'm just going to give him credit for that. Yeah.
I think that's safe.
Yeah.
To say.
One other quick thing from the credits. There's a really small moment where there's a cop she's putting someone's skis that she had just confiscated into the back seat of her car.
Dina Star shoot.
Yeah. It cracked me the fuck up. Who's shot that? What's going on
there?
I
did. It was, there was like a Dina Star team shoot, And it was like a bunch of French folks that came over and like we were doing a park shoot. I think they like brought American flags and like, anyways, we went and shot an urban feature that we did like the, it was behind like the fast food restaurants in Silverton, the like barrier walls. Mm. And they wanted all the athletes, all the like skiers to do it at once. And cops came and like confiscated all the skis. And like, I think they got them back, but like the team, like the people from Dinastar were kind of back and forth, like arguing with the cop. And, but I wish I had a better story. It was kind of a weird, like really like quirky thing we were kind of shooting just to like, it was more, not really for the movie, but like more for shooting some stuff for Dinastar to like sponsorship stuff.
Yeah. Well, I was entertained by it regardless.
And then I met,
so.
And then I met stabbed a guy.
Oh man. Looking at my notes, kind of out of left field here, but a couple of the like crazier things that went on in my world that year in particular. So we were shooting in Grand Targhee at Tanner Ainville, Wiley Miller, and this Euro-Austrian dude named Flo, who's hanging out with us for a little bit. And for some reason, I think Austin Holt, who was shooting photos, and I were hanging out at the bar in Grand Targhee after everybody else left. And we were one of the last people to leave. And we're in the parking lot, starting to pull out, and this homeless looking drunk dude just kind of like falling on himself stumbles up to our car and is just kind of like leaning on the hood of my Land Cruiser. We're trying to like pull out of the parking lot. It's like, oh, what is going on here? And this dude kind of like meanders over to the driver's side. I roll down the window and he like straight up puts his head and shoulders like into the vehicle.
Nice.
Yeah, he's like, you guys give me a ride home. Like, just like completely out of his mind. Greg Stump, my childhood filmmaking superhero who lived in, what is that, Driggs?
Victor, Idaho.
And was like, yeah, just guys, give me a ride home. And I was like, oh, okay. I mean, clearly he's going to die if we don't put him in the vehicle and take him home. So let's do that. And we brought him down to his place in Victor. And that turned into like many, many hours of Austin Holt and I hanging out with him. And those dudes getting high and me drinking some beers and just like shooting the shit with him as he began to sober up a little bit and have some mildly intelligent conversations. It was pretty fucking amazing. And obviously like we were able to connect on the fact that I was making ski films and, you know, I watched his films growing up and we sat in his studio, which, you know, he owned this crazy little property that had formerly been owned by a photographer. And I think the like large garage had been turned into a photo studio, which then Stumpy had turned into his own video studio. And he had just racks of all his like digi beta tapes of all his 16 mil transfers and probably 8 mil transfers from like everything that he's ever shot. And just like walls of photos and newspaper clippings of like these unreal historical like moments and events and things
it's
that
like
had happened.
Museum.
Straight up a museum
centric,
but like
a Stumpy museum.
Oh my god, and like statues of gargoyles and just like crazy shit everywhere. Yeah. And yeah, it was
it's like
it
how
was,
you can imagine like Hunter S. Thompson's house would look
straight up. I mean, that's pretty much like the biggest parallel you can draw as far as this, like, you know, older, like very eccentric, like crazy person who has actually like done so many things. I mean, straight up, he's showing us like these newspaper clippings of him like winning junior national championships in freestyle ballet from the late 70s. And it was just like running the full gamut and just like one of those things I will straight up never forget. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, if I had had a phone at that point that had taken photos, I'd have the most amazing photos of us all like hanging out together. And I mean, that certainly wasn't a thing, so it didn't happen. But certainly these wild memories of being part of all that and seeing like where all this stuff went down.
That's crazy.
We would have some more Stumpy Greg Stump stories.
That's chapter one of Level One Adventures with Greg Stump. Yeah. Please tune in next week for chapter two, where shit gets really crazy.
Back when making ski films was way more difficult. Shooting film and laptops.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
It sounds like he was probably drunk for every single shoot he ever did, though.
Ah, oh, fuck. He definitely partied hard. But yeah, those guys all in the 80s, Blizzard of Oz. Sex lies and
they
duct
didn't,
tape.
Let's just say they didn't not party.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But yeah, it was a pretty wild experience.
Your first Alaska trip this year, Josh?
Yeah.
You want to touch on that real quick?
For sure. I mean, that's definitely one of the other major groundbreaking things for us.
Right.
That season was going to Alaska for the first time. And obviously, like I mentioned before, bringing Decker on board freed me up in a lot of ways, or so I felt, to explore these different avenues. And we did earlier in the season our first cat skiing trip, which was a crazy experience. And now this with, at least Stephen Thomas was the common denominator there, but along with Tanner Rainville and Steele Spence, our first trip to Alaska. And, you know, we were absolutely green, flying blind here. I didn't know the first thing about where to go or what we do. So we ended up in Valdez, which, of course, you know, we know now is some of the larger terrain and probably not like where you really want to cut your teeth as far as like filming goes. Mm. But we didn't know any better, and we had some kind of connection to H2O. I think they offered us some sort of like kind of deal, which ultimately probably wasn't really a deal, but we thought it was. So we jumped on board with them at the time. And we went, I want to say it was like mid-April. And spent, I want to say, like, we had a week lined up of flight time, and we had to, like, pay for an hour a day or something like that. And
minimums.
Yeah, minimums. Ultimately, the conditions were terrible, and we were just dealing
visibly
with
terrible in the part.
Like
you
a crazy
see
wind
yeah,
event.
Yeah, crazy wind event. Like, there was a lot of moisture, but a crazy wind event, and we just kind of got screwed. And we made the most of it. I mean, I think even watching it last night, it's very much like a documentary-style part where we did this and this was our experience and we tried this and this worked and this didn't. And at least, I don't know, I'm slightly biased, but I thought it was like a cool watch at least. But it was such an eye-opening experience that there was this big world, literally and figuratively, operating outside of the confines of what Level One had even been exposed to at that point. Obviously, your TGRs and matchsticks and even Poor Boys, who were, you know, making the bigger ski films at the time, like, you know, that was, you know, old hat to them. But for us, this was like a real like foray into something really new, which I'm not going to say Alaska came to play a big role in what we did in the future. But, you know, we definitely dabbled in it as much as we could in coming years. And it was very, very much eye opening and, you know, broke the ice for us in a lot of ways. And I'll never forget, though, how small we felt. Just, you know, beyond the context of the train and us all being kind of just blown away by things. And me personally, I'm afraid of heights. So being dropped off for some of these Barbie shots on just like these 2,000-foot precipices with photographer
the Chew Badge is big, even on Alaska standards, because the ice fields there, the glaciers are like a fucking mile wide.
Yeah.
Like in some places, they're huge. So
sure.
Everything is massive. I remember when you got back, and I was fascinated with Alaska, and I was like, what was it like? What was it like? Like, tell me what happened. Like, what was it like? And you're like, dude, like, my very first impression, like, you don't like ski like mountains from like the top to the bottom. You ski like little parts of mountains. Mm. And those
like
are
a
like
1500 foot part of a mountain. Yeah.
Those are like what you think of as like a big Alaska line is like just a little part of a mountain. So I thought that was a funny takeaway, which is totally true, especially there where the relief is crazy. But Steele got pretty jacked, eh?
He did. So I think everybody was just, well, if not intimidated, certainly very excited at this opportunity. And that manifested in us maybe in some ways trying to push a little harder than we could. And
well, you got money in the line, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that
definitely like fucks with your head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially first time. If you're not used to that, you're like, I have to make the most of this money.
Sure. No, that is definitely a thing. But to circle back on that, yeah, so Steele Seal ends up hitting a cliff that he took a little too big. The landing was flatter and a little firmer than he thought, and he jacked his back up pretty good. And that was the end of his trip for sure. And in a lot of ways, the end of his professional skiing career. I don't think we really shot with him after that. I don't think he was pushing too hard into
Minimally,
it.
Minimally, yeah.
And it's crazy. Even looking at the interview, you can see the expression of pain on his face.
He can barely keep his head straight.
He can't. And, you know, I remember him at the time just like grimacing through that whole process, but wanting to like stand up for this interview and kind of like, you know, fake it till you make it, just to like, mm-hmm. you know, have that presence and be like, yeah, I'm okay. Even though he really wasn't. Damn. And, it was definitely a shitty way to end his season for sure. But the other takeaway, just in the context of how small we were, is I do remember the Brain Farm crew was out there shooting for That's It, That's All.
Okay.
And what's that? Never heard of it.
Yeah, it's a bunch of snowboarders. And anyway, in the context of us, you know, putting down as much money as we could possibly scrounge together for maybe 5 or 7 hours, like whatever our minimum buy-in was for that week, Brain Farm had 2 helis and was shuttling a crew of what must have been 15 to 20 people into these zones. Because their answer, of course, to having shitty conditions was just to build massive jumps and hit trannies, which is fine if you have the knowledge and the experience and the ability and the resources to do it, which they did. But I don't want to quote, like, or don't quote me on the hours or whatever, but I want to say that they had prepaid for like 60 or 80 or 100 hours, something just obscene, because they were there for a whole month with 2 helicopters where they were planning on flying all month long, non-fucking stop. And so I remember that they didn't even come close to like using all of the hours that they had even paid for. And I just remember like cruising around at one point and they have this assembly line of dudes building a jump like miles and miles and miles from the fuel drop. And just, it's like, oh, okay, like, cool. We're just going to go over here and Steele's going to hurt his back and then Stefan's going to miss the shot and then we're going to go home. You guys build that 150-foot step over.
It didn't work, though.
No, it didn't. It did not. Nope. That one in particular. But anyway, it was just this very, very humbling, like, oh, my God, like, we are nothing.
We're junior varsity.
Not even, man.
We're middle school, JV. Yeah. These guys
are Alaska, at least.
These guys are college.
Yeah.
These are in the pros, yeah. Yeah.
Word. Well, you two have anything, any last thoughts you want to touch on before you jump off?
Awesome. Pretty stoked to be a part of that movie, and thanks Berman and Friedel for trusting and bringing probably both of us on board, because that started a whole era that I'll never forget. Certainly some good times.
Hell yeah, man. Right back at you. No brainer having you guys involved.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a fun year.
Good times.
Such a long year.
Very thankful that you were.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fucking crazy. Like
team sports.
Tom, as a young head, like, you've always been, you know, like, X Games God, whatever, to me. So to hear about you, like, bumming it and living on the road and sleeping on a mattress in the back of the car and living at Hood for a month and a half, like, is both humanizing and fucking sick. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was bum life until about 2011 or 2012. We definitely did some Hood rat shit, but it was fun. That was probably
start
the best
winning
of times.
X Games.
Yeah, once you start winning X Games, you get a little bit more money.
Yeah,
no, it was so fun though. I mean, finishing that rail and then driving back with Kyle and like just all that stuff is like so cool. Like kids, I don't know if kids really knew it at the time, but like so much of it seems so baller being a pro skier. But I mean, Hornback and all these guys, it was so much of a hustle, but just so fun at the same time. Like, wouldn't change any of it for the world.
Fuck yeah.
Oh yeah.
Hell yeah, dude.
Awesome. Sweet.
Well, I can't wait to see this movie. We've seen a sneak peek at the segment we were involved in, and we're super happy with how that's turning out. And I haven't seen any other bits of the movie, but I'm kind of, maybe Friedel and Berman, or you guys can send us some links.
We've literally done nothing else, so we have a lot to do.
All right.
Come
get
to the
working,
premiere.
Get working, boys. Get working.
I know. On that note, this is a good point to wrap this up and get back to editing, which is exactly what I'm going to do. I got to go find a song for Keegan Kilbride and edit his 5-minute
mega part. Aren't you supposed to plug your tour dates right now? When's the world premiere?
That's what I get to do after the fact. He's gonna do but it. Yeah, the 21st. I hope to see both of you there.
I already got my ticket booked.
I think I'm going to be coming straight from Hawaii, so it's going to be tough.
Perfect. Bring that tan with you.
You know me. I'm very tan. Yeah, thank you boys so much for having us on. It's been fun talking old times.
Appreciate it.
Fuck yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for listening. That was episode 9 of Level 20. Go watch the movie if you somehow didn't. It's so sick. It'll be free until the end of this podcast series. So you got a couple months to check it out if you're listening to this late. Real quick, all the things you can do and ways to support and engage. Email us questions, podcast@level1productions.com. Buy your romance DVD pre-order. Buy your tickets to the Denver premiere September 21st. Check out the events page if you want to host a tour stop. Rate us on iTunes. Go check out the Level One store. Follow us on the gram. Check out our newsletter. Newsletter's at the bottom of the homepage if you want to sign up. And tell your friends about the pod because we got more awesome ones coming your way soon. Thanks for listening, y'all.